listening to part three of a three-part conversation between Dr. Rick Blackman and Dr. John Ortberg, both clinical psychologists, talking about Jesus and worry. If you missed part one and two, you can catch up on our YouTube channel or our website, becomenew.com. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes or conversations from Become New. Now here's John and Rick.
You have another phrase that I love that you could maybe say a little bit about. You talk about being in the anxiety club. And what does it mean to be in the club, or at least to have a guest membership?
Well, everybody has some thorn that they're dealing with. And for my money, anxiety is the principal thorn for a very, very large number. That club. And I think the anxiety club is when that is one of your core structures. And it's a very large club. Lots of people. I'm a guest member. I don't think I'm a member in it all the time. Hopefully I've made some progress at this in my 60s now. But I know what it's like to be in that club. And a lot of people, they're going to be in that club forever. And that's often the reason I say it, is that somebody's in the club. I usually am saying it to somebody I think is going to always be in that club. So our goal is not to eliminate, only death is going to eliminate the, you know, club membership. So following the words of Jesus, getting tools, thinking this through, processing it, not being a ruminator, not being an avoider, those are things that are going to be part of your management strategies, your coping strategies from now on. So I never mean it as a note of disillusionment. If you're in that club, and a lot of people listening to us, I can tell you are nodding their heads and they're thinking to themselves, either my wife's in that club, my husband's in that club, or I'm in that club, or my kid's in that club. And that's okay. It's a really large club. You're not alone.
So when you accept it, actually, ironically, accepting it can enable you to embrace life and find God in the midst of that in ways that if you always try to avoid and pretend it's not the case, you'll never do.
Oh, rejecting club membership is as rejecting anxiety.
Turns out
we hate our anxiety and reject the experience even that we're having of worry and anxiety will make it worse. So we do have to kind of go through the side door of just being honest and real about this.
So that actually flows wonderfully into the next question I have for you. Jesus goes on, and why do you worry about clothes? See how the flowers of the field grow. Do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you? And it's interesting here, often in the Old Testament, in Isaiah, you see the same theme in Job and in the Psalms. The image of flowers of the field, grass, is used to show human fragility. All flesh is as the grass, and life is as the flowers of the field. The grass withers, the flowers fade. Here, Jesus actually takes that and sees even in the lilies of the field God's care, and builds on that to say, you are that much more in God's care. What was striking in thinking about it was Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed in the splendor of one of these, that there's beauty, that what God cares for, he sees beauty in. And we all want to look good. We all want to be clothed in splendor, but we're afraid that we're not. And it was striking to think about Eleanor Stump in her book, Wandering in the Darkness. She talks about how shame is associated with something pretty close to ugliness, feeling like there is not attractiveness or beauty or a quality inside me that other people would want to be around. And I think of that shame that people can feel because I'm in the anxiety club or I'm in the depression club. Or I'm in the ego club, or I'm in the not very attractive club, or not smart enough club, or whatever the club is, there's shame attached to it. How do you work with folks on shame and anxiety? What's the connection there?
I always think of shame, and I love how often you bring Elizabeth Stump into the conversation. You really like her work, don't you?
I do.
I think of it as the one down way of approaching life, you know, that I'm one down, you know, you can take the other one idea. And I always push hard for trying to adopt and move emotionally and in your brain to a same as mentality, to kind of counter that shame piece. And that is a spectacular piece here about as Solomon in all of his splendor doesn't equal the flowers, the grass. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, it's that invitation that worrying about that stuff is like a no-go. Jesus is saying it's not gonna be useful, not gonna be helpful to you. Trusting God with that. He knows, I think you're going to read in a little bit, right? He knows that you need these things, that you need clothes and that you need food. And so to worry about it, to spend time brooding over that, again, is going to be just ineffective.
So let me probe a little bit on the same level, not one down. In the Bible, there'll be places where, like Paul, when he's writing to the Philippians, says, in humility, consider others better than yourselves. What do you take him to mean by that? And how is that different than the wrong kind of other people are better than me thought?
Well, if it comes from a self-critical standpoint, self-hating standpoint, that's what I mean by one down. I mean, being other-oriented and serving others and considering their needs. I mean, in some ways, again, human beings tend in their worst parts of themselves to go the one down or the one up direction. So sometimes I think a lot of those passages are trying to address the superiority.
People that are putting themselves one up.
Yeah, I'm one up and I'm more grandiosity, and so I'm better than others. I really think the Bible's kind of full of injunctions to not do either. Mm-hmm. We're all the same. We're all the same in God's eyes, beloved in God's eyes, you know, Jew, Greek, male, female, and what have you. So I think I think we just always have to hit that when it's present, trying to be aware of shame or, again, its counter, the other side. You know, if we're talking about a dynamic tension between ruminating and avoiding, then there's so many other ones, you know, between grandiosity and shame. That's another one, trying to be in that calm, sweet spot, that dynamic tension in between those.
So then Jesus ends that question with a little phrase, and it's a word that it's thought he very possibly coined, you of little faith. Oligopistoi, oligarchs, the rule of the few, pistis, faith, epistemology, that notion that you don't have enough faith. And he often uses that with his disciples. And I think about that with anxiety, because a lot of times there'll be people that are Christians and they feel like, oh, if I really had enough faith, I wouldn't be anxious. And then they get even more anxious because now they feel like, in addition to their anxiety, they're guilty of not trusting God enough. So that becomes kind of a vicious cycle downward. I know a lot of your clients are people of faith, Christians. How much do they wrestle with that? I must not trust God enough. And how do you help their faith to be an asset in this struggle as opposed to one more source of feeling guiltily inadequate?
That is hard work, John. That is not an easy question. I know that the Bible's general definition of anxiety is that it's preoccupation with tomorrow and the future. And that's not only in this passage of Jesus, but with Paul or John or Peter are talking or writing about it. That's the same thing. And so that idea that if I'm thinking about tomorrow, then I'm more likely to worry and be anxious. And the antidote, and I think of this as an operational way to think about faith, that I'm going to, and I think this is how Dallas puts it, is it not? That I'm going to put outcomes into God's hands, yeah. And I'm going to consciously and try to get that all the way down into my emotions to put the outcome of my efforts in God's hands, because that's future oriented. That's tomorrow, metaphorically. And then be about what I'm doing in the moment. That doesn't get me off the hook. It doesn't mean that I can't put out effort, but I'm not in charge of the outcome. God's in charge of the outcome. That's the future. So when I think of it myself, when I think of it helping my clients, that's how they grow. That's how, and that is interesting, that little line, "O ye of little faith." It's like he's recognizing in this great sermon and this great passage,
yeah,
that it is an invitation to trust God, put faith in God for the outcome of the things that in my humanity I tend to brood about, worry about, think about, obsess about.
Yeah, no, and there's something a little comforting. It's kind of like he's putting us all in the same boat there, because it's not directed. Sometimes he directs it just specifically to a disciple or these disciples. Here's the Sermon on the Mount. So it's just kind of the assumption. Yeah, if you're a human being, you got a problem where you just have little faith.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And again, thinking about that being an operational way of thinking about trust. This is how faith makes a difference, is outcomes are not up to me. And even when I say it that way to you, John, that's comforting to me. Oh, yeah, okay, that's right.
Outcomes are not up to me. Yeah, yeah. Do you have time for one more?
Yes, this is great. This is so fun. So I love that Greek stuff you threw in there too. Like, you're the Bible guy. I love that. So
there you go.
Just offer a little bit from a psychologist standpoint.
That's good. The final question that I have for you in this very, very rich passage, he says, so, and then he repeats this command again for the second time. He'll do it a third time by the end of the chapter. Do not worry, saying, what should we eat or what should we drink or what should we wear? And then, for the pagans run after these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. And I thought, this is interesting. This is one of the places where he contrasts life in the kingdom, not with the religious hypocrites, but with the pagans, with the Gentiles.
Yeah.
And the verb that's used is run, which connotes hurry, anxious,
chase,
striving. And that's what characterizes pagans. So let's talk for a minute about worry and pace of life, worry and hurry. A sense that there's not enough time, unable to relax, inability to be present in that, in the moment. Do you find that your Christian clients run less than your pagan clients do? And how do you see the relationship between worrying about life, tomorrow, all of that stuff, and then running?
You know, that's a really great question. Someone has not asked me it in that way. I would say it this way. My Christian clients who are steeping themselves in the Sermon on the Mount, on the teachings of Jesus, are less hurried. They have more peace. Like, I think love, joy, peace, patience, you know, those fruits of the Spirit. Mm-hmm. It seems like they come from the Spirit, they're gifts of the Spirit, but they seem so tied to unhurrying. You know, John Mark Comer's The Ruthless. Oh, I guess that's really Dallas, isn't it? The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. Urgent. It feels like I'm talking about urgency and hurry and worry all the time with Christian clients, but the ones who are taking time to really unpack passages like the one that we're talking about right now, I see it makes a huge difference. It's partly why I like being a Christian therapist. I don't only see Christians, John, but I do feel like if someone is a follower of Jesus, they have some really incredible resources at their disposal. Mm-hmm. If bring in these words, and I'm speaking to myself, I don't think I'm a naturally peaceful guy. I'm more driven. Ambitious, you know, move fast. My wife's nickname for me when we started dating was Schnell, which is German for fast. I do think fast, right? And I, I'm still that way, but I think I've just wanted to try to drink this in and be less, moving quickly on to the next thing in life. And that's mostly because of trying to emulate Jesus and his words.
So for everybody listening right now, just stop. You don't have to be in a hurry. Don't end this video prematurely. Ruthlessly eliminate hurry. Remember, you have a heavenly Father who cares for you. And so life does not have to be a frenzied, urgent, rushed, preoccupied, anxious, striving. His gift today is peace. So today, when you're at the keyboard writing an email, when you're in the car driving someplace, what a blessing you will be to those around you. When you're talking with little children, when you're all by yourself, do not have to run. Peace. Rick, this has been so rich. I have loved going through this passage with you and looking at it from a clinical perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, John. So fun.
Hi, I'm Tim. I'm a part of the team here at Become New. We've been in a series on Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7, and today concluded the final episode in Matthew chapter 6. Now tomorrow, John's going to spend a couple days talking about Holy Week and Easter. Then we'll go on a one-week break and return to conclude this series walking through Matthew chapter 7. If you're new to the channel, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss any of those future episodes that I just talked about. And if you like what you hear, you can find all of our episodes, over 700 10-minute teachings, on the person you're becoming at our website, becomenew.com. If you have a prayer request, please share it with us. There's a group of us who meet each weekday to pray for viewers just like yourself. You can text it to us at 855-888-0444. We'd love to pray for you. We'll catch you next time.